from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll take a look at Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson's proposed budget for 2025. Then a Latinx LGBTQ activist talks about her work in the city.
It was imperative that I brought my people together. And by my people, I mean my Latino community that identified as LGBTQ.
Plus, we'll learn about Milwaukee's new initiative to tackle food waste.
Wisconsin is definitely among the higher end of food insecurity in the United States. Globally, it's a massive issue. On average, the amount of food that we waste exceeds 40, and in some areas even 50%.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Late last month, Milwaukee's Mayor Cavalier Johnson submitted his proposed city budget for next year. The $200 million budget addresses everything from funding our parks, libraries, and police. So what happens now? And what should we know about what's in the mayor's proposed budget? To find out more, Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with the president and co-founder of Urban Milwaukee, Jeremy Janine, who's been covering city government for the past decade.
Jeremy, thank you so much for coming in to the studio and talking to us about the mayor's budget, which the proposed budget, which was released, I don't know, at this point, like a week and a half ago or so. Where exactly are we in the budget process? Where did that proposed budget go? And then where will it eventually end up?
So by a series of statutes and the city charter and a bunch of other factors, the city introduces its budget. The mayor introduces the budget in late September every year. Then the Common Council spends all of October reviewing it. And that review includes a public hearing with feedback on it from the community. It includes departments presenting it. And then in early November, it'll actually be when you wake up the day after the election, it'll be Council Budget Adoption Day.
How much movement happens between the proposed budget and then everything that happens in the council? Like, how much of this budget that we'll talk about do you expect to get changed or kind of tinkered with?
So it's about a $2 billion budget. The amendments will be around like $300,000 a year, $400,000 a year. But they add up to have a huge impact because things like Sunday library hours, that was an amendment to this year's budget. And that was a big debate. It wasn't a ton of money on a $2 billion budget, but it has a big impact in people's lives.
$2 billion, as you were talking about, the amendments will come. What about the mayor's budget as is, though, sit out to you?
We're in the second year now of the sales tax. And the interesting thing to me, one key important thing, and as a Milwaukee resident, I'm happy to see this. And I think everyone in Milwaukee and everyone statewide should be happy to see the sales tax. The city is collecting even more than they thought they would. And that's a really healthy thing for the budget because that means, one, they estimated correctly, or they actually underestimated. But two, that means the money that was projected to come in to fund city services is there and can continue to fund those services. Going back before Act 12 that enabled the sales tax, the situation for the city budget was really dire. The city just did not have enough revenue and costs were going up.
Mm-hmm. What are the other effects of Act 12? You kind of brought that up. It was the sales tax that was implemented. There was also some pretty strict language in there about police staffing and dealing with the city's pensions as well. How's that looking?
Act 12 was a grand compromise between local governments, often led by people with Democratic Party affiliations, and the state legislature, which is currently led by the Republican Party in both the Senate and the Assembly. And so this compromise wasn't just, we're going to give you City of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, we're not just going to give you a new sales tax and say, spend it as you see fit. There was a lot of restrictions that came with it. And two of the key restrictions are police and fire staffing have targeted levels that the city must reach in a decade. And if sales tax collections continue to go up, more and more money must go to hiring more police and firefighters. So we're seeing that in the 2025 proposed budget. For the fire department, they use this average daily sworn strength level, and that's going to go up by 7. So there'll be a new firehouse, a new old firehouse, the reopening of a firehouse that was previously closed because of budget cuts.
One thing that's been written about, too, is the borrowing for a lot of these larger capital projects. Where exactly are they borrowing from and how much are they borrowing?
They're borrowing from you, me, and people that have retirement funds invested in bonds everywhere. So they just go sell the debt on the public market. And they don't borrow as much to plug budget holes. The city's been pretty good about that. But the capital needs, so the city rebuilds a bridge. They don't pay the full cost of that bridge on year one. They say, okay, here's a 10-year debt instrument or a 30-year debt instrument. And the challenge has been that you have to pay that interest every single year. Anyone with a mortgage or student loans is familiar with this, that every month they want that money. Same thing for the city. And every time the city borrows more money, because the cost of all these things is going up, that cost, that monthly cost is going up. And this year we're seeing more borrowing, which means in the future it's going to be more and more difficult to pay. It means just more budget pressure every year, more budget pressure if you're borrowing more. The challenge then really becomes, well, how do you stop borrowing? People want their streets to be fixed. Well, you borrow to rebuild streets. So that becomes a real challenge for the city to navigate.
Can I throw a couple like quick fire community talking points that I saw just pop up around the mayor's proposed budget to you?
Yeah, and we should talk about property tax and assessments.
One of the big ones I saw was that there was an increase again to property taxes. I believe it was around 2%.
Correct.
Just people commenting left, right, and center about when does it stop? Is this what I should expect every year? Property taxes going up. Take it away with their Facebook questions on that one.
All right. Property taxes in Wisconsin are complicated when it comes to how it affects your city budget and your individual property tax rate. The amount of money the city can collect in total is about $300 million, and that's capped by state law. So this year, and you can increase it by a couple small factors, like if a new building is built, the assessed value of that building can be used to raise the amount of money city collects. So if you're growing, the amount of money you can collect, growing physically as a city, the amount of money you can collect goes up. The challenge for a city like Milwaukee is it's not physically growing. There's not farm fields being turned into houses in Milwaukee. So it has to deal with constraints. Well, this year, the net of all this new construction is about 2%. Does that mean your individual property taxes will go up by 2%? Not necessarily. And this is where it gets complicated. It's best described as splitting up a dinner check. And that's Alderman Scott Spiker's analogy. How that $300 million gets collected is based on your assessment of your property. So if your house goes up by, let's say, 10% in its assessed value, but the average house in Milwaukee goes up by 12%, your property tax rate or property tax bill is actually likely to go down. Now you're like, okay, but that didn't happen for me. And that's because the city of Milwaukee is only one of three or four entities that collect property taxes. There was a Milwaukee Public Schools referendum,
right,
entirely separate from city government, included raising the amount of money MPS can collect substantially. And that's where everyone paid an increase then, because the amount of money they could collect went up.
Just to run this by you then, if I have property assessment jumped up 10%, the city's overall assessment for residential housing 12%, I may actually see a decrease in my property tax.
Yes, and that I can say that is a truthful thing, because it actually happened to me. My house went up fairly substantially.
Congratulations.
went up fairly substantially in value, but the net of everything that happened that year, and this was 2021, I believe, was my actual property tax bill went down by like $35.
Thank you for that. This is not turning into a quick hits part of the interview, but that's fine. The other question that I had and that I had seen kind of float around in a bunch of places where people asked, how does the city compare to other cities with similar populations? And they pointed to some cities like Charlotte or Nashville, which have a billion or sometimes double the budget that Milwaukee does. If we could fund our transit system or our park system or our library systems more robustly, what do you say to folks that ask that question about how do we compare to other cities, similar size cities?
It's very difficult to compare Milwaukee to another city, because the state of Wisconsin, as we talked about, that cap on property taxes, there's just a lot of different factors. There's also the definition of what is the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County. The city of Chicago includes a transit system in its budget. It includes parks in its budget. It includes schools in its budget. So I don't even know how big their budget is, but it's enormous. In Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee includes none of those entities in its budget. Parks and transit are part of the county's
MPS is
schools.
Almost the same size as the city's budget.
Yep, it's an entirely separate thing. So it gets very complicated to make true comparisons. But the other key factor, and this has been more divergent up until recently with Act 12, is the city of Milwaukee really had no other revenue source other than property taxes and fees. Now it has a sales tax. But if you look at a place like St. Louis, they have an income tax, I believe. They can change the geographic footprint of their government, meaning they can annex land. The city of Milwaukee has been the same 97 some square miles for several years. So that it's more of a static thing than a city like a Nashville or a Charlotte that's geographically growing.
I also wanted to ask you about the Policy Forum, which just released its analysis of the mayor's budget, which you've written about. What did you learn there?
There was one key word I took away from that report, and that's precarious. The report identified that Act 12 has had a positive impact on the city's budget, that there are not major cuts this year, but that the way the city is avoiding the major cuts this year is withdrawal from these reserve funds. And the way the reserve funds are set up, they get refilled at a certain amount every year. But the amount the city is withdrawing is probably not sustainable in future years. So the city entered this year with an $87 million structural deficit, meaning that if the city wanted to do everything in 2025 like it did in 2024, it basically was short $87 million. The proposed budget from the mayor does about $10 million in cuts. It recognizes some extra sales tax revenue, but half of that gap closing, about $40 million, is pulling from reserves. The city might only be able to pull in future years at about a $20 million level. I'm just hypothetically throwing out a number, which means it's going to have to do $20 million more in cuts or $20 million more in fee increases, which would be an astronomical amount of fee increases.
It's hard to look into a crystal ball and predict what could happen, but what do you expect over the next 2 to 5 to 10 years with this city's budget? Like, what should folks get ready for?
I've been closely watching the city of Milwaukee budget for about 10 years now. I've been covering it since at least 2018, every year writing several, if not a dozen articles about just the budget process. The one thing I'd say is I still think there are cuts in the horizon. Act 12 did not solve all the city problems, and there are difficult decisions to be made. But without Act 12, the cuts would be so astronomical, the city would not resemble itself. There'd be mass layoffs of police and fire and other general city workers. So there's a solvable problem ahead, and that challenge is going to rear its head 2026, 2027, and it could come earlier if the economy tanks. It could be postponed if the economy doesn't, but there will eventually be a day where the city needs to make really hard decisions about around the edges about what services to cut or totally re-envision how they're provided.
That was Jeremy Janine, Urban Milwaukee president and co-founder. He spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. Carmen Alicia Murguia is a third-generation Milwaukeean. She's a poet, a journalist, an activist, and a staunch supporter of LGBTQ+ people of color. Murguia says she's seen LGBTQ visibility go from being virtually non-existent to being more tolerated and accepted, especially among her Mexican-American family. She tells WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell, it's influenced her writing and her activism, and it's contributed to her creating workshops that support LGBTQ people. Murguia shares how she became involved in activism and how that led to her creating opportunities to support the LGBTQ and Latinx communities in Milwaukee.
I have to take you back to when I started being an activist as one of the few Latinas out there who was out as a lesbian, and starting with in the 80s, the late 80s, 88, 89, coming out in the Milwaukee community around AIDS and HIV through the Milwaukee AIDS Project, and just having a presence in our community during a time where we did not have an LGBT community center, where we did not have Diverse and Resilient, where we did not have the 16th Street Community Health Center, LGBTQ, AIDS and HIV outreach, and all the important work that's being done now started many, many years ago. And I was one of the people who helped spearhead the Latino community that brought together the LGBTQ population. And the way I went about it was just who I am, you know, who I am as an out lesbian and as out proud Mexican-American living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And as an activist in the city of Milwaukee, it was imperative that I brought my people together. And by my people, I mean my Latino community that identified as LGBTQ. And it just made sense for me to lead that effort. I come from a family of leaders. I come from a socially conscious family. I'm proud of that and proud of my history. And so leading up to these workshops for the intersectionality of being LGBTQ and Latina, Latino in the United States just made sense because it didn't exist. I did the workshop with Creating Change Conference, a conference of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. I did the workshop for LULAC National, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and at the Milwaukee LGBT Community Center, which I helped found back in 1996. And then also through Diverse and Resilient, once held a health and wellness conference. And I did the workshop there, and my workshops will be packed. They'll be full because people are hungry to talk about it, to learn, to see someone who looks like them, feels like them, acts like them, walks like them, talks like them. And I love my community. I just do. And that's where it comes from. It comes from my corazón.
Did Milwaukee create this atmosphere where it was easy to kind of do the work that you do, or was it challenging? Like, I wonder how Milwaukee made it possible for you to do the work that you do.
Oh, I made it possible to do the work that I did. Milwaukee didn't. You see, I'm a product of the 70s and late 60s. I was a child born in 66, and I'm a product of the 70s. So that was a time that you really couldn't be out. Like, and then as a Latina, you know, as a Mexican American, we just sort of looked at each other when we'd walk down the street, you know, or like stare from across the way in grade school or summer program or high school. And so being that it was an unspoken thing, I had to keep it under wraps. You know, I had to stay quiet and closeted until I decided it was right for me, you know. And I came out to myself and through my Catholicism when I was 7 years old. So to carry that through my 20s was a lot. You see what I'm saying? And for a little girl to know that Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, Our Lady of Guadalupe, who's the patron saint of Mexico and the Americas, and God, you know, for me, that was very powerful for me to say, hey, I know you will protect me. And I pray that you do. And I felt that. I felt that connection. And so I was able to be myself inside. And then later shape my life around the city of Milwaukee and bring my people in through parades, through marching in the parade, through coming out in the Journal Sentinel newspaper. When the Journal Sentinel did a piece on coming out in the workplace, this is back in the 90s, 1996, I believe, when the Journal Sentinel did this piece and gathered a lot of the leaders and a lot of people who were out in the community. So it was about, I would say about 100 of us. And you had to be invited. That was the thing. You had to be invited. And I knew in my heart, I was going to be the only one, the only Latina representation there. So I purposely invited my friend Juana. I said, Juana, you got to come with me. You got to, we got to be present, because if some little Latina girl or a teenager or an older woman doesn't see us in that photograph, they're going to stay quiet. But if they see us, they're going to feel proud and they're going to say, that's me too. And it turns out that My father at the time, God rest in peace, Dr. Filiberto Murguia, who ran the Council for the Spanish Speaking for 37 years. At the time, there was a woman named Barbara Burbach. And Barb is Mexican. And she had a daughter who was lesbian and hadn't come out to her. And because I appeared in the newspaper, Barb said to my dad, she said, I know this is hard for you, Filiberto, but because your daughter was in the newspaper, my daughter saw her and said, Mom, so am I. Mm. And that made all the difference. It's just one person could identify and say it out loud. This young person of a different generation, younger than me, would say that. I did my duty. Mm. You know, I did what I was placed on this earth to do.
Carmen, I want to thank you for really being vulnerable in expressing that with me. You know, you point to a very important concept, I think, which is that representation really matters. Even just one person seeing someone like them, it makes a world of difference.
It's so old and I can't believe I still get choked up by it.
It just means that much to you. Yeah. You love when things like that stick with you. I wanted to go back to you were talking about being a 7-year-old and knowing the challenges of being a girl, being LGBTQ, being Mexican, and like what those challenges, you know, all rolled into one could mean for you. Have there ever been tension points with those aspects of your identity?
Yeah. A lot of tension. I couldn't be out in my family of origin. You know, my parents, you know, I was raised Catholic, raised, you know, very traditional Mexican American. You know, my mom was born here to Mexican parents, and my mother's also Carmen. My father, Filiberto, you know, was a very prominent leader in the community. And so I think in a way, they really wanted to protect us from any retaliation, any danger, any name calling, any discrimination. I think that was their way of protecting me, and I didn't get it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then in the community, no one really talked about it, like in the Latino community. No one talked about that we were here, you know, that we're queer and we're here. And so that was a big challenge. That was a big challenge for me and for my LGBTQ sisters and brothers. We all came out in the bars because in the bars, we were safe. In the gay bars, we were safe. We could dance our lives away. We could be ourselves, let our hair down, wear it short, wear suits, you know, wear dresses, you know, heels, however we wanted to identify, however we wanted to be. It was the bars that allowed us to be. And so one of the things that I did also was recreate the definition of family, familia, for myself, because when you're ostracized and not accepted by your own, you create family. Mm-hmm. My family are my LGBTQ sisters and brothers, and my family is also my allies. When we're able to bring our whole selves, whether it's to our families, to our friends, to our friends who become our families, to the workplace, to our personal activities, to our hobbies, to community centers, to senior centers. You know, there's a lot of us older seniors that go back in the closet because of fear of not being cared for or being discriminated against because of who they are and how they love. How we love, and that's the bottom line. So yeah, there have been a lot of challenges, but it feels like I'm a fighter.
Carmen Alicia Murguia is a local journalist and activist. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. Join us tomorrow to hear more of their conversation. Murguia will share more about the activism she's most proud of and how far she thinks LGBTQ plus rights have come. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we're heading to Mamie's on Milwaukee's South Side to learn about the city's best dive bars. But first, we'll tell you about Feed MKE, a program working toward solutions for food insecurity and food waste. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A new city program is dedicated to tackling food waste, food insecurity, and climate change in Milwaukee. Feed MKE is rooted in the coalition that helped shape the city's climate and equity plan. Now, thanks to federal funding, it's become a program that's run out of Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office, or ECO. WUWM's Lena Tran speaks with Andy Shaka from ECO, who leads the program.
I was looking at ways that we could fill the gap and, you know, things like composting, reducing food waste through education, how we talk to folks about things like freezing or fermenting, how we get better cooperation between gleaners and growers and, you know, individuals who are hungry, and wrote this huge policy project on it. And that ended up being my job, interestingly enough. It was just one of those things where, you know, the city at that time had applied for a grant from the USDA's Compost and Food Waste Reduction Program. And they posted the job. And I thought, well, this is interesting because this is the job.
I wrote a thesis on
this. Yeah, exactly. This is a job I said needs to exist. And the teacher part of me, right, that sort of teacher's heart is engaged daily because I'm learning new things from all of my colleagues and from within the community. And I get to share information with others. So, you know, it really kind of is the perfect marriage of everything that I care about and the things that I happen to be pretty good at.
Yeah. Just to lay the groundwork, what do we know about how much food is wasted and, you know, the cost or the impact of that in Milwaukee or, you know, across the Wisconsin?
Wisconsin is definitely among, you know, sort of the range of what we see in the higher end of food insecurity in the United States. Globally, it's a massive issue. We know that on average, the amount of food that we waste exceeds 40 and in some areas even 50% of what is produced. So much of the waste occurs before we even get it into our homes. In Wisconsin, 17% post-pandemic, Milwaukee residents are experiencing food insecurity on some level. And yet we waste astronomical amounts of food. We have a great agricultural, you know, sort of basis. There's gleaning opportunities that are missed. Restaurants, especially the sort of independent restaurant community in Milwaukee, is very close, very collaborative. And so, you know, the question really is, how do we get the most amount of food to the people who need it? And how do we keep the most amount of organic waste from sitting in a landfill? The other piece of it is what we do with what we cannot use. Of course, that's where composting comes in. Anyone who's concerned with climate understands that methane gases are released when food or organic matter is decomposing in landfills. How do we get really good compost to the growers, gleaners, farmers, producers, so that we can continue that cycle of creating healthy and nutritious food, getting it to the people who need it, capturing what we can from the waste, and then sort of putting it back into the soil to create a more healthy ecosystem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it sounds like Feed Milwaukee, like as a program, is looking at all the gaps and things that aren't working out for people in our food cycle. Like, can you talk about some of the big like community connections that you're hoping to make?
Absolutely. So Feed MKE is indeed the pilot project that's being launched through this grant. Feed is an acronym standing for Food Excess Equitable Distribution. And the Feed MKE Coalition included a group of more than 80 volunteers from public and private partnerships who really gathered as part of the work group process that went into the Milwaukee Climate and Action Plan from 2023. So the initial group, like I said, was more than 80 volunteers. We're now at about 120 committed folks who are leading sort of, you know, little groups or subgroups within that coalition. And, you know, we are planning to invite even more organizations, individuals, university partners, hospital partners, you know, hotels, farmers, gleaners, growers. We really want to have a coalition that's representative of the entire food system. And there's a lot of areas where we've identified sort of gaps in communication or connection. So while we're doing this sort of comprehensive study, we're saying, oh, okay, so maybe we just need this solution to try and address this part of the problem. And then this other part of the problem that we know exists could be more readily addressed through increased, you know, funding or having that person maybe who's an innovator and wants to help launch a business solution that would, you know, sort of support that goal. Anyone who cares about climate, planet, city, food is welcome to join the coalition, bring their ideas. We are at sort of early stages, but the benefit is that we're capitalizing on and leveraging the incredible wealth of experience, commitment, and passion, not only of the pre-existing coalition and all the folks who worked on, you know, the work groups for the Climate and Equity Plan, but honestly, this is an issue that impacts everybody because everybody eats.
Yeah. And this all falls under the umbrella of Milwaukee's Climate and Equity Plan. Can you say more about how fighting food waste can also build racial and economic equity in our city?
Absolutely. So we know that disproportionate numbers of BIPOC residents are impacted by food insecurity. We know that funding for BIPOC businesses, whether that's at the startup level or scaling up, are compromised. The Climate and Equity Plan includes very specific metrics, right, around reduction of waste. The goal is to reduce the greenhouse gases, right? The goal is to employ more people. You know, there's a very specific metric in the Climate and Equity Plan of jobs that earn $40,000 or more. But it's not just sustainable consumption and food reduction. It's also the creation of better systems that are more inclusive and that create additional opportunities for us to collaborate and work together. Food is highly subjective, even though it's universal, and we want to include all voices in that conversation. The Feed MKE project will definitely create opportunities for more people to talk about the things that matter across the board. And in many ways, having just the space to have the conversation is a critical component of the equity piece. Are the right people representing the needs of each community? And that means our, you know, members of every community represented in ways that feel generous, right? And food is a great, again, a great tool for that, a great vehicle for that.
Feed MKE is looking at stakeholders, if you will, of different scales, whether it's like businesses or, you know, the food pantries, the growers. And then there's also ways for individuals to get involved, right? What does that look like?
Sure. So individuals are always welcome at the coalition conversations. As I said, there'll be courses online, there'll be workshops, we're launching a podcast, there'll be cook-alongs, there'll be community dinners. They can, you know, sort of work with one of our other partners. So there's, you know, a growing list of folks who are offering either volunteer opportunities, donation opportunities, or providing resources for folks who are in need. Our website is up. And we've got a lot of early engagement points there for people. If you're an organization and you're a large scale organization like a, you know, hospital or a hotel, you can certainly work with us to create better solutions for how you're capturing food waste. You may be introduced directly to a food pantry so that if you have an event, how are we getting that food to folks who need it? We really are looking to connect with anyone, again, who has an interest in sharing in the conversation with us. One of the most exciting aspects of my job is that I get to make connections, which is something that I've always loved to do and something that I think is really important, right? Lists of links on a website are great. Articles are great. But my belief and what I'm really excited about, you know, in the investment that both the USDA and ECO and the city have made in this role that I occupy is that the power is in the conversation. You know, and I think just even helping people really sort of know what's being done and how we can amplify that. How can we better support the groups who are doing really good work in this area already? and how can we help them collaborate in more meaningful ways so that there's not, you know, a reduplication of effort, and so that, you know, folks aren't struggling to kind of find a model if a model exists.
Well, okay, so if someone's hearing this and they're just really interested to get started now, what are some strategies that you can share for Milwaukeeans who just want to reduce their food waste at home?
That's a great question. So I think one of the main ways, and we often forget this, that you can reduce the waste is by doing thoughtful meal planning and making sure that you're creating sort of a grocery list for yourself that includes recipes where you can use as much of what you're bringing home as possible. Freezing, fermenting, you know, all of those sort of tips and tricks. So there's a lot of things we can do to reduce waste. And it often starts for the consumer or the individual sort of like person in a household at the grocery store before you go to the grocery store, let's say. So you have a plan, you know how you're going to use things when you bring things home. You know, you have another plan for what you'll do if you know you're not able to use things as quickly as you would like. And then when you do find that you have waste, you know, composting buckets don't have to be complicated, right? The one we have in the eco office is just one of those sort of, you've seen them, they're the big orange pails, right? Like that you can get at any sort of a home building store. But if you keep compost and, you know, you are thoughtful about what you toss, utilize the recycling resources, engage with partners who are doing some of the work for collecting compost. If you can, grow things. So I think just starting wherever you can is the most important way to really, you know, make things happen. But again, it's about having a conversation and developing a plan and sort of thinking ahead about what you want to produce, what you want to consume, and how you intend to dispose of what you can't consume.
Awesome. Well, it sounds super exciting. And there's so much to look forward to ahead. Is there anything I didn't ask that you would like to mention?
Right now, we're also at an exciting time with the Feed MKE project because part of the funding is being redistributed to the community. So of the $400,000 grant that we received, we are putting $127,500 back into the community. And that grant application is currently open. Applications are open until the end of November. November 22nd is the cutoff date. And they are in two categories. So they're capacity building for food recovery and food waste reduction efforts. There's sort of buckets on the website that explain what that might look like, but I'll just give you one example. It could be working with a farm or a grower and helping get that gleaned produce, you know, to a food pantry or to another sort of resource. So we're looking for projects that would increase sort of retention of food out of the sort of food waste cycle, get it to more hungry people. The other bucket for that same grant would be a compost-related project. It could be, you know, business that's willing to serve as a vendor for some of the available compost that we have. It could be someone who, you know, wants to propose a project for their organization to actually support the idea of going around and collecting compost and getting it to a production facility. So there's lots of different options that people can actually get funding for. And we are aware that many organizations simply don't have staff or capacity to have someone on hand who can write grants, nor do they have the resources to write them themselves. So we have workshops throughout the month of October, both virtually and in person, where we will be walking people through the process, helping them actually complete the application. But I'd love to see as many proposals from Milwaukeeans as we can possibly get, knowing that that means that, you know, again, we're throwing our efforts behind this really important project. And, you know, it would be wonderful to see all $127,500 end up in the community in the hands of people who may not yet be involved, but really want to work for this to make a difference.
Andy Shaka is the coordinator of the Feed MKE program. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we're heading to Mamie's in Silver City to learn about some of Milwaukee's best dive bars. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Dive bars are as much a part of Milwaukee culture as beer and pull tabs. This month's Milwaukee Magazine is celebrating some of the best dive bars in the city. I met up with Mail Mag's executive editor, Chris Drosner, at one of the bars featured in the magazine, Mamie's. Over its more than 40 years in business, Mamie's has become an institution in Silver City on Milwaukee's south side, serving a diverse clientele and offering some top-notch dive bar amenities, like pool, dice, and even a working payphone. The term dive bar is a bit divisive. How did you go about figuring out what a dive bar was for this article?
Yeah, it is very subjective. And you know, especially with Debbie, we were sensitive to, you know, that one connotation of dive. And we did what we always do with stories like this. We kind of took a celebratory tone. But yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot that goes into it. For the bars that we actually featured, the photography was really important for us. We wanted them to look great. So the visuals inside the bar were really important first. And then, you know, is it a good bar? Is it a place that we would, like, feel good sending people to? Because that's not always the case with every dive, right? And then there was the question of, well, can we really make a case that this is a dive? And that wasn't really the case with a lot of bars that we considered. And maybe, I mean, you could make an argument that, like, maybe Stella's, which is one of the bars that we featured, isn't truly a dive, even though it's right there in its own name. It's like Stella's, a cocktail dive. But, you know, we did this little piece of the package is signs that you're in a dive and signs that you're not. And frankly, one of them is there a cocktail menu? And Stella's has a cocktail menu. You know, I mean, we kind of broke our own rules a little bit, but it's dive bars. It's supposed to be fun, right?
Yeah, it's fun. So with that in mind, what are some of the signs that you're in what you'd call a dive bar?
This is probably the most fun piece of the whole thing that I had putting together, because, like, the research for this was, like, going to bars and just thinking about where you're at and what makes it what it is and kind of deconstructing the dive bar experience. And that, like, it's a different way to think about bars than the way that you usually are thinking when you're in a bar. So, yeah, this was fun. I mean, most of these are, like, signs of, like, maybe, like, lower quality bars, or definitely, like, the family kind of aspect, which kind of came through in a couple of the profiles. But, like, someone lives upstairs is one of the things. Like, these are in neighborhoods, and people live here. You know, crock pots. Like, you know, these are places where people are really comfortable with each other, and they'll bring in, you know, like, snacks, or, you know, like, meatballs for game day, or whatever it might be. You know, Just Arts down in Walker's Point is one, and I think they do kind of a sketchy-ish kind of like crockpot buffet on certain days and stuff like that. So
when you say sketchy-ish, you mean like it's a potluck that
anybody
who comes to the bar is
kitchen.
Okay.
Yeah. Totally. You know, like, funny signs. Like, there was this one place in West Dallas that we went to that ended up on the list but not as featured. And it's got a sign on the exterior door that says, "Use doorknob, please." Which raises a lot of follow-up questions, but...
Who wasn't using the door?
Yeah, couldn't get in otherwise, right?
What was happening that the sign had to be put there to say, please use the doorknob?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. A lot of it has to do with, like, choice or lack of choice, you know, kind of the activities that are happening. Bar dice is one of them. There's a CD jukebox, you know, that, I mean, there's one here at Mamie's. You know, kind of these throwback things that are being kind of pushed out of these newer places that in many cases are replacing legitimate dives.
Mamie's even has a payphone.
Oh my God, is there? I wish I'd noticed that. Oh my God.
Under the barber pole.
Under the barber pole.
That's where to find it. So with that in mind, we just pointed out there's a payphone in here. There is also a jukebox, as you mentioned. They have bar dice. What are some of the other attributes that landed Mamie's on the dive bar list?
Well, one of the things that really hooked us on this one, which I had heard about Mamie's for a long time before actually coming here. And one of the things I had heard was that it's super friendly. Everybody's very welcoming. This is a bar on 33rd and National. So, you know, near South Side. It's very welcoming. It's very diverse. And when I say diverse, I mean people of all walks of life, people of all ages, people of different ethnic backgrounds. So, you know, it's a very unusual bar in Milwaukee, which, you know, and kind of just socially, I think people kind of tend to cluster into their little groups and their little cliques, and that is not really happening here. Everybody is just together, and when you're here, oh my God, what is that? I was just about to say some kind of advertising slogan. When you hear your family, what is the Olive Garden?
Yeah.
But you really
it's
do.
It's the
you
Olive
really
Garden
do feel
of
welcome.
Dive bars.
That, you really do feel welcome. And actually, that I felt that in all the bars that we ended up featuring, which I think I went to all of them.
I've been to a lot of the bars that you feature. What are some of the different bars that are featured in this?
We had a really tough time picking these. I mean, there's so many to choose from in Milwaukee. And really, like I said, the kind of the deciding factor in a lot of these ended up being how they look. But I mentioned Just Arts. That's one of them. With the loquacious owner and bartender there, Art. JMO's over on the east side is another one, which has been one of my favorite bars since I discovered it a few years ago. The light in there is just, it feels like exactly how I want my bar lit. Low, soft, colored, beautiful. It's great, just a great bar. And good vibes too. Dale's, which is up on 61st and Capitol, or 62nd and Capitol maybe, which is, you know, primarily African-American, but it has this, like, it was founded by this guy, Dale, who was a clown. Like, that was kind of what he did outside of the bar business. And so there is a ton of clown stuff. It's just one of those, like, super weird, like, everything's, like, what is this? So, and the soup is great, too. So, it's super interesting mix of kind of culture and again, super friendly, and all this clown memorabilia, really? Like, what's the deal there?
Very interesting.
So we also included Stella's, which I mentioned, downtown, in this kind of weird part of downtown where there's not really a lot of other places. It's like by the library and Barrett Center. So it's kind of in this little backwater, but really cool, kind of cocktail oriented, definitely a newer type of dive, but good vibes there. Only two beers on tap, which I feel like that was like a feather in its cap as far as like whether it's a dive or not. And then of course Mamie's here on the south side. Oh, and Gordy's. I almost forgot about Gordy's, which is just this quintessential neighborhood bar in a little neighborhood in St. Francis. Feels like it could be in any small town in Wisconsin.
Very nice. So I did a call out to see which shots were very Wisconsin or Milwaukee. And there were two main contenders. One was a blackberry liqueur. It's like a Polish liqueur.
Polish blackberry brandy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a blackberry brandy or Rumpelmann's.
Rumpelmann's, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What do you think is kind of a quintessential Milwaukee shot?
I mean, I'm going with whiskey chased by a PBR or a High Life. You know, the Boilermaker? I mean, I think that's probably it for me. Anything nasty. I mean, I'll get
anything
down with
nasty.
Or Fernet or...
You're getting down with... I don't know about your choices.
No Malort? No Malort for John?
Look, I've had Malort. We've all had Malort.
Have we?
Well... Many of us have had Malort. If you've ever accidentally sprayed perfume in your mouth, you've had Malort.
I mean, that's just rude to Malort, but probably true.
It's rude to the perfume, to be fair.
But, you know, like, that's, to me, I want to know I'm drinking a shot. Give it a little burn.
Fair enough. All right. I'm going to see if the lovely Michelle will come over and explain bar dice and play dice with us.
This dude comes to the corner bar, pretty normal all week, but on Friday he's a star. Does pickle juice, tequila, and white Russians too.
Chris Drosner is the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine, and he worked on this month's feature on dive bars. At WUWM.com, you can hear me, Chris, and my colleague Sam Woods learning how to play dice with Mamie's bartender, Michelle Belling. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you about Old World Wisconsin's Halloween-themed event called Legends and Lore. Plus, we'll check out the River West Radio Ghost Walk and learn about some of the spooky homes featured in the tour. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
And I said, sure, I'll take a wild night with you. I just like the way you do.